ambulance, and she liked that, too. It was like the rides at the Topsom Fair when she and her sisters had been young, the crazy cups and the wild mouse. Scott never minded the turbulent interludes either. She remembered one particularly mad approach into Denver. Strong winds, thunderheads, little prop-job commuter plane from Death's Head Airlines all over the smucking sky, and how she'd seen him actually pogoing in his seat like a little kid who needs to go to the bathroom, this crazy grin on his face. No, the rides that scared Scott were the smooth, downbound ones he sometimes took in the middle of the night. Once in a while he talked, lucidly, smiling even, about the things you could see in the screen of a dead TV set. Or a shot glass, if you held it tilted just the right way. It scared her badly to hear him talk like that. Because it was crazy, and because she sort of knew what he meant, even if she didn't want to. So it isn't low barometer that's bothering her, and it certainly hadn't been the prospect of getting on one more airplane. But in the bathroom, reaching for the light over the sink, something she had done without incident or accident day in and day out for the entire 8 years they'd lived on Sugartop Hill, which came to approximately 3,000 days, less time spent on the road. The back of her hand whacked the water glass with their toothbrushes in it and sent it tumbling to the tiles where it shattered into approximately 3,000 stupid pieces. "Shit, fire, save the smuckin' matches," she cried, frightened and irritated to find herself so, for she did not believe in omens. Not Lisi Landon, the writer's wife. Not little Lisi de Buscher from the Sabattis Road in Lisbon Falls, either. Omens were for the shanty Irish. Scott, who had just come back into the bedroom with two cups of coffee and a plate of buttered toast, stopped dead. "What'd you break, baby love?"
"Nothing that came out of a dog's ass," Lisi said savagely, and was then sort of astonished.
That was one of Granny de Buscher's sayings, and Granny D certainly had believed in omens, but that old Colleen had been on the cooling board when Lisi was barely 4. Was it possible Lisi could even remember her? It seemed so, for as she stood there, looking down at the shards of tooth glass, the actual articulation of that omen came to her, came in Granny D's tobacco-broken voice, and returns now as she stands watching her husband be a good sport in his lightest weight summer sport coat, which he'll soon be sweating through under the arms nevertheless. Broken glass in the morning, broken hearts at night. That was Granny D's scripture, all right, remembered by at least one little girl, stored up before the day Granny D pitched over dying in the chicken yard with a snarl in her throat, an apron filled with bluebird feed tied around her waist, and a sack of beechnut scraps slid up her sleeve. So, not the heat, the trip, or that fellow Dashmeal, who only ended up doing the meet and greet because the head of the English department is in the hospital following an emergency gallbladder removal the day before. It's a broken, smucking tooth glass combined with the saying of a long-dead Irish granny. And the joke of it is, as Scott will later point out, that is just enough to put her on edge, just enough to get her at least semi-strapped. Sometimes, he will tell her not long hence, speaking from a hospital bed. Ah, but he could so easily have been on a cooling board himself, all his wakeful, thoughtful nights over, speaking in his new whispering, effortful voice. Sometimes just enough is just enough, as the saying is. And she will know exactly what he's talking about. 4. Roger Dashmeal has his share of headaches today, Lisi knows that, though it doesn't make her like him any better. If there was ever an actual script for the ceremony, Professor Hegstrom, he of the emergency gallbladder attack, was too post-op muddled to tell Dashmeal or anyone else what or where it is. Dashmeal has consequently been left with little more than a time of day and a cast of characters featuring a writer to whom he has taken an instant dislike. When the little party of dignitaries left Inman Hall for the short but exceedingly warm walk to the site of the forthcoming Shipman Library, Dashmeal told Scott they'd have to more or less play it by ear. Scott had shrugged good-naturedly. He was absolutely comfortable with that. For Scott Landon, ear was a way of life. "I'll introduce you," said the man Lisi would in later years come to think of as Southern fried chicken shit. This as they walked toward the baked and shimmering plot of land where the new library would stand, The word is pronounced Labri in Dashmalese. The photographer in charge of immortalizing all this danced restlessly back and forth, snapping and snapping, busy as a gnat. Lisi could see a rectangle of fresh brown earth not far ahead, about 9 by 5, she judged, and trucked in that morning by the just-starting-to-fade look of it. No one had thought to put up an awning, and already the surface of the fresh dirt had acquired a grayish glaze.
"Somebody better do it," Scott said.
He spoke cheerfully, but Dashmeel had frowned as if wounded by some undeserved canard. Then, with a meaty sigh, he pressed on.
"Applause follows introduction."
"As day follows night," Scott murmured.
"And you'll say a word or two," Dashmeel finished.
Beyond the baked wasteland awaiting the library, a freshly paved parking lot shimmered in the sunlight, all smooth tar and staring yellow lines. Lisi saw fantastic ripples of non-existent water on its far side.
"It will be my pleasure," Scott said.
The unvarying good nature of his responses seemed to worry Dashmeel.
"I hope you won't want to say too much at the groundbreaking," he told Scott as they approached the roped-off area.
This had been kept clear, but there was a crowd big enough to stretch almost to the parking lot waiting beyond it. An even larger one had trailed Dashmeel and the Landons from Inman Hall. Soon the two would merge, and Lisi, who ordinarily didn't mind crowds any more than she minded turbulence at 20,000 feet, didn't like this either. It occurred to her that so many people on a day this hot might suck all the air out of the air. Stupid idea, but...
"It's mighty hot, even for Nashville in August. Wouldn't you say so, Tony?"
Tony Eddington nodded obligingly but said nothing. His only comment so far had been to identify the tirelessly dancing photographer as Stephen Queensland of the Nashville American, also of U-10 Nashville, class of 85.
"Hope y'all will help him out if you can,"
Tony Eddington had said to Scott as they began their walk over here.
"You'll finish your remarks," Dashmeel said, "and there'll be another round of applause. Then, Mr. Landon..."
"Scott."
Dashmeel had flashed a rictus grin there for just a moment.
"Then, Scott, you'll go on and turn that important first shovelful of earth."
"Turn?
First? Earth?"
Lisi mused, and it came to her that Dashmeel was very likely saying, "turn that all-important first shovelful of earth," in his only semi-believable Louisiana drawl.
"All that sounds fine to me," Scott replied, and that was all he had time for, because they had arrived.
5. Perhaps it's a holdover from the broken tooth glass, that omenish feeling. But the plot of trucked-in dirt looks like a grave to Lisi. XL size, as if for a giant. The two crowds collapse into one around it and create that breathless suck-oven feel at the center. The campus security guard now stands at each corner of the ornamental velvet rope barrier, beneath which Dashmeel, Scott, and Tone Eddington have ducked. Queensland, the photographer, dances relentlessly with his big Nikon held up in front of his face. Paging Ouija, Lisi thinks, and realizes she envies him. He is so free, flitting gnat-like in the heat. He is 25 and all his shit still works. Dashmeel, however, is looking at him with growing impatience, which Queensland affects not to see until he has exactly the shot he wants. Lisi has an idea it's the one of Scott alone, his foot on the silly silver spade, his hair blowing back in the breeze. In any case, Ouija Jr. at last lowers his big camera and steps back to the edge of the crowd. And it's while following Queensland's progress with her somewhat wistful regard that Lisi first sees the madman. He has the look, one local reporter will later write, of John Lennon in the last days of his romance with heroin. Hollow, watchful eyes at odd with disquieting contrast to his otherwise childlessly wistful face. At the moment, Lisi notes little more than the guy's tumbled blonde hair. She has little interest in people watching today. She just wants this to be over so she can find a bathroom in the English department over there across the parking lot and pull her rebellious underwear out of the crack of her ass. She has to make water, too, but right now, that's pretty much secondary.
"Ladies and gentlemen," Dashmeel says in a carrying voice, "it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Mr. Scott Landon, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Relics, and the National Book Award-winning The Coster's Daughter. He's come all the way from Maine with his lovely wife, Lisa, to inaugurate construction. That's right. It's finally happening. On our very own Shipman Library. Scott Landon, folks. Let's hear y'all give him a good Nashville welcome.
The crowd applauds at once, con brio. The lovely wife joins in, patting her palms together, looking at Dashmeal and thinking, he won the NBA for the Coaster's Daughter. That's Coaster, not Coster. And I think you know it. I think you smucked it up on purpose. Why don't you like him, you petty man? Then she happens to glance beyond him, and this time she really does notice Gerd Allen Cole, just standing there with all that fabulous blonde hair tumbled down to his eyebrows, and the sleeves of a white shirt far too big for him rolled up to his substandard biceps. The tail of his shirt is out and dangles almost to the whitened knees of his jeans. On his feet are engineer boots with side buckles. To Lisi, they look dreadfully hot. Instead of applauding, Blondie has clasped his hands rather prissily, and there's a spooky sweet smile on his lips, which are moving slightly, as if in silent prayer. His eyes are fixed on Scott, and they never waver. Lisi pegs Blondie at once. There are guys, they're almost always guys, she thinks of as Scott's deep space cowboys. Deep space cowboys have a lot to say. They want to grab Scott by the arm and tell him they understand the secret messages in his books. They understand that the books are really guides to God, Satan, or possibly the Gnostic Gospels. Deep space cowboys might be on about Scientology or numerology or, in one case, the cosmic lies of Brigham Young. Sometimes they want to talk about other worlds. 2 years ago, a deep space cowboy hitchhiked all the way from Texas to Maine in order to talk to Scott about what he called leavings. These were most commonly found, he said, on uninhabited islands in the southern hemisphere. He knew they were what Scott had been writing about in Relics. He showed Scott the underlined words that proved it. The guy made Lisi very nervous. There was a certain wall-eyed look of absence about him. But Scott talked to him, gave him a beer, discussed the Easter Island monoliths with him for a bit, took a couple of his pamphlets, signed the kid a fresh copy of Relics, and sent him on his way, happy. Happy? Dancing on the smucking atmosphere. When Scott's got it strapped on tight, he's amazing. No other word will do. The thought of actual violence, that Blondie means to pull a Mark David Chapman on her husband, does not occur to Lisi. My mind doesn't run that way, she might have said. I just didn't like the way his lips were moving. Scott acknowledges the applause, and a few raucous rebel yells, with the Scott Landon grin that has appeared on millions of book jackets, all the time resting one foot on the shoulder of the silly shovel while the blade sinks slowly into the imported earth. He lets the applause run for 10 or 15 seconds, guided by his intuition, and his intuition is rarely wrong, then waves it off, and it goes, at once, foom. Pretty cool, in a slightly scary way. When he speaks, his voice seems nowhere near as loud as Dashmeal's. But Lisi knows that even with no mic or battery-powered bullhorn, the lack of either here this afternoon is probably someone's oversight, it will carry all the way to the back of the crowd. And the crowd is straining to hear every word. A famous man has come among them, a thinker and a writer. He will now scatter pearls of wisdom. Pearls before swine, Lisi thinks. Sweaty swine at that. But didn't her father tell her once that pigs don't sweat? Across from her, Blondie carefully pushes his tumbled hair back from his fine white brow. His hands are as white as his forehead, and Lisi thinks, there's one piggy who keeps to the house a lot. A stay-at-home swine, and why not? He's got all sorts of strange ideas to catch up on. She shifts from one foot to the other, and the silk of her underwear all but squeaks in the crack of her ass. Oh, maddening. She forgets Blondie again in trying to calculate if she might not, while Scott's making his remarks, very surreptitiously, mind you. Goodma speaks up. Dour. Three words. Brooking no argument. No, Lisi. Wait. Ain't gonna sermonize me, Scott says, and she recognizes the patois of Gully Foyle, the main character of Alfred Bester's The Star's My Destination, his favorite novel. Too hot for sermons.
Beam us up, Scotty.
Someone in the fifth or sixth row on the parking lot side of the crowd yells exuberantly. The crowd laughs and cheers.
Can't do it, brother, Scott says. Transporter's all broken and we're all out of lithium crystals.
The crowd, being new to the riposte as well as the sally, Lisi has heard both at least 50 times, roars its approval and applauds. Across the way, Blondie smiles thinly, sweatlessly, and grips his delicate left wrist with his long-fingered right hand. Scott takes his foot off the spade, not as if he's grown impatient with it, but as if he has, for the moment at least, found another use for it. And it seems he has. She watches, not without fascination, for this is Scott at his best, just winging it.
It's 1988, and the world has grown dark, he says.
He slips the ceremonial spade's short wooden handle easily through his loosely curled fist. The scoop winks sun in Lisi's eyes once, then is mostly hidden by the sleeve of Scott's lightweight jacket. With the scoop and blade hidden, he uses the slim wooden handle as a pointer, ticking off trouble and tragedy in the air in front of him.
In March, Oliver North and Vice Admiral John Poindexter are indicted on conspiracy charges. It's the wonderful world of Iran-Contra, where guns rule politics and money rules the world. On Gibraltar, members of Britain's Special Air Service kill three unarmed IRA members. Maybe they should change the SAS motto from "Who dares wins" to "Shoot first, ask questions later."
There's a ripple of laughter from the crowd. Roger Dashmeal looks hot and put out with this unexpected current events lesson, but Tony Eddington is finally taking notes.
Or make it ours. In July we goof and shoot down an Iranian airliner with 290 civilians on board. 66 of them are children. The AIDS epidemic kills thousands, sickens, well, we don't know, do we? Hundreds of thousands? Millions? The world grows dark. Mr. Yates' blood tide is at the flood. It rises. It rises.
He looks down at nil but graying earth, and Lisi is suddenly terrified that he's seeing it. The thing with the endless patchy piebald side. That he's going to go off. Perhaps even come to the break she knows he is afraid of. In truth, she's as afraid of it as he is. Before her heart can do more than begin to speed up, he raises his head, grins like a kid at a county fair, and shoots the handle of the spade through his fist to the halfway point. It's a showy pool shark move, and the folks at the front of the crowd go, ooh. But Scott's not done. Holding the spade out before him, he rotates the handle nimbly between his fingers, accelerating it into an unlikely spin. It's as dazzling as a baton twirler's maneuver, because of the silver scoop swinging in the sun, and sweetly unexpected. She's been married to him since 1979 and had no idea he had such a sublimely cool move in his repertoire. How many years does it take, she'll wonder two nights later, lying in bed alone in her substandard motel room and listening to dogs bark beneath a hot orange moon, before the simple, stupid weight of accumulating days finally sucks all the wow out of a marriage. How lucky do you have to be for your love to outrace your time? The silver bowl of the rapidly swinging spade sends a wake-up sunflash across the heat-dazed, sweat-sticky surface of the crowd. Lisi's husband is suddenly Scott the Pitchman, and she has never been so relieved to see that totally untrustworthy, "Honey, I'm hip," huckster's grin on his face. He has bummed them out. Now he will try to sell them a throat full of dubious get-well medicine, the stuff with which he hopes to send them home. And she thinks they will buy, hot August afternoon or not. When he's like this, Scott could sell Frigidaires to Inuits, as the saying is. And God bless the language pool where we all go down to drink, as Scott himself would no doubt add, and has. But if every book is a little light in that darkness, and so I believe, so I must believe, corny or not, for I write the damn things, don't I? Then every library is a grand old ever-burning bonfire around which 10,000 people come to stand and warm themselves every day and night. Fahrenheit 451 ain't in it. Try Fahrenheit 4,000, folks, because we're not talking kitchen ovens here. We're talking big old blast furnaces of the brain, red-hot smelters of the intellect. We celebrate the laying of such a grand fire this afternoon,
and I'm honored to be a part of it. Here is where we spit in the eye of forgetfulness and kick ignorance in his wrinkled old cojones. Hey, photographer!
Stefan Queensland snaps too, smiling. Scott, also smiling, says,
Get one of this. The top brass may not want to see it, but you'll like it in your portfolio, I'll bet.
Scott holds the ornamental tool out as if he intends to twirl it again. The crowd gives a hopeful little gasp, but this time he's only teasing. He slides his left hand down to the spade's collar, digs in, and drives the spade blade deep, dousing its hot glitter in earth. He tosses its load of dirt aside and cries,
I declare the Shipman Library construction site open for business!
The applause that greets this makes the previous bursts sound like the sort of polite patter you might hear at a prep school tennis match. Lisi doesn't know if young Mr. Queensland caught the ceremonial first scoop, but when Scott pumps the silly little silver spade at the sky like an Olympic hero, Queensland documents that one for sure, laughing behind his camera as he snaps it. Scott holds the pose for a moment. Lisi happens to glance at Dashmeal and catches that gentleman in the act of rolling his eyes at Mr. Eddington. Tona. Then he lowers the spade to port arms and holds it that way, grinning. Sweat has popped on his cheeks and forehead in fine beads. The applause begins to taper off. The crowd thinks he's done. Lisi thinks he's only hit second gear. When he knows they can hear him again, Scott digs in for an encore scoop.
This one's for Wild Bill Yates, he calls. The Bull Goose Looney. And this one's for Poe, also known as Baltimore Eddie. And this one's for Alfie Bester, and if you haven't read him, you ought to be ashamed.
He's sounding out of breath, and Lisi is starting to feel a bit alarmed. It's so hot. She's trying to remember what he had for lunch. Was it something heavy or light?
And this one?
He dives the spade into what's now a respectable little divot and holds up the final dip of earth. The front of his shirt has darkened with sweat.
Tell you what, why don't you think of whoever wrote your first good book? I'm talking about the one that got under you like a magic carpet and lifted you right off the ground. Do you know what I'm talking about?
They know. It's on every face that faces his.
The one that, in a perfect world, you check out first when the Shipman Library finally opens its doors. This one's for the one who wrote that.
He gives the spade a final valedictory shake, then turns to Dashmeal, who should be pleased with Scott's showmanship, asked to play by ear, Scott has played brilliantly, and who instead only looks hot and pissed off.
I think we're done here, he says, and tries to hand Dashmeal the spade.
No, that's yours, Dashmeal says, as a keepsake and a token of our thanks, along with your check, of course.
His rictus smile comes and goes in a fitful cramp.
Shall we go and grab ourselves a little air conditioning?
By all means, Scott says, looking bemused, and then hands the spade to Lisi, as he had handed her so many unwanted mementos over the past 12 years of his celebrity. Everything from ceremonial oars and Boston Red Sox hats encased in lucite cubes, to the masks of comedy and tragedy, but mostly pen and pencil sets. So many pen and pencil sets. Waterman, Scripto, Schaefer, Mont Blanc, you name it.
She looks at the spade's glittering silver scoop, as bemused as her beloved. He is still her beloved. There are a few flecks of dirt in the incised letters reading Commencement Shipman Library, and Lisi blows them off. Where will such an unlikely artifact end up? In this summer of 1988, Scott's study is still under construction, although the address works and he's already begun storing stuff in the stalls and cubbies of the barn below. Across many of the cardboard boxes he scrawled, Scott, the early years, in big strokes of a black felt-tip pen. Most likely the silver spade will wind up with this stuff, wasting its gleams in the gloom. Maybe she'll put it there herself, then tag it, Scott, the middle years, as a kind of joke. Or a prize. The kind of goofy, unexpected gift Scott calls it. But Dashmeal is on the move. Without another word. As if he's disgusted with this whole business, and determined to put paid to it as soon as possible. He tromps along the rectangle of fresh earth, detouring around the divot which Scott's last big shovelful of earth has almost succeeded in promoting to a hole. The heels of Dashmeal's shiny black I'm an assistant professor on my way up and don't you forget it shoes sink deep into the earth with each heavy step.
Dashmeal has to fight for balance, and Lisi guesses this does nothing to improve his mood. Tony Eddington falls in beside him, looking thoughtful. Scott pauses a moment, as if not quite sure what's up, and then starts to move, slipping between his host and his temporary biographer. Lisi follows, as is her wont. He delighted her into forgetting her omenish feeling, broken glass in the morning, for a little while. But now it's back, broken hearts at night, and hard. She thinks it must be why all these details look so big to her. She's sure the world will come back into more normal focus once she reaches the air conditioning. And once she's gotten that pesty swatch of cloth out of her butt. This is almost over, she reminds herself, and how funny life can be. It is at this precise moment when the day begins to derail. A campus security cop who is older than the others on this detail, 18 years later she'll identify him from Queensland's news photo as Captain S. Heffernan, holds up the rope barrier on the far side of the ceremonial rectangle of Earth. All she notices about him is that he's wearing what her husband might have called a perfectly huge batch of orifice on his khaki shirt. Her husband and his flanking escorts duck beneath the rope in a move so synchronized it could have been choreographed. The crowd is moving toward the parking lot with the principals, with one exception. Blondie isn't moving toward the parking lot. Blondie is standing still on the parking lot side of the commencement patch. A few people bump him, and he's forced backward after all, back onto the baked dead earth where the Shipman Library will stand come 1991, if the chief contractor's promises can be believed, that is. Then he's actually moving forward against the tide, his hands coming unclasped, so he can push a girl out of his way to his left, and then a guy out of his way on the right. His mouth is still moving. At first, Lisi again thinks he's mouthing a silent prayer, and then she hears the broken gibberish, like something a bad James Joyce imitator might write. And for the first time, she becomes actively alarmed. Blondie's somehow weird blue eyes are fixed on her husband, there and nowhere else. But Lisi understands that he doesn't want to discuss leavings or the hidden religious subtext of Scott's novels. This is no mere deep space cowboy. The church bells came down Angel Street, says Blondie, says Gerd Allen Cole, who, it will turn out, spent most of his 17th year in an expensive Virginia mental institution and was released as cured and good to go. Lisi gets every word. They cut through the rising chatter of the crowd, that hum of conversation, like a knife through some light sweet cake. That run gut sound, like rain on a tin roof, dirty flowers, dirty and sweet, that's how the church bells sound in my basement, as if you didn't know. A hand that seems all pale fingers goes to the tails of the white shirt, and Lisi understands exactly what's going on here. It comes to her in shorthand TV images. George Wallace, Arthur Bremer, from her childhood. She looks towards Scott, but Scott is talking to Dashmeal. Dashmeal is looking at Stephen Queensland, the irritated frown on Dashmeal's face saying he's had quite enough photographs for one day, thank you. Queensland is looking down at his camera, making some adjustment, and Anthony, Tona Eddington, is making a note on his pad. She spies the older campus security cop, he of the khaki uniform and the perfectly huge batch of orifice. He is looking at the crowd, but it's the wrong smucking part. It's impossible that she can see all these folks and Blondie too, but she can. She does. And she can even see Scott's lips forming the words, "Think that went pretty well," which is a testing comment he often makes after events like this. And oh God, oh Jesus Mary and Jojo the Carpenter, she tries to scream out Scott's name and warn him, but her throat locks up, becomes a spitless dry socket. She can't say anything. And Blondie's got the bottom of his great big white shirt hoiked all the way up, and underneath are empty belt loops and a flat hairless belly, a trout belly, and lying against that white skin is the butt of a gun, which he now lays hold of and hears him say, closing in on Scott from the right. If it closes the lips of the bells, it will have done the job. I'm sorry, Papa. She's running forward, or trying to, but she's got such a perfectly huge case of glue foot, and someone shoulders in front of her, a strapping co-ed with her hair tied up in a wide white silk ribbon with Nashville printed on it in blue letters outlined in red. See how she sees everything? And Lisi pushes her with the hand holding the silver spade, and the co-ed caws, "Hey!"
Except it sounds slower and draggier than that. Like Hey recorded at 45 RPM and then played back at 33 and a third, or maybe even 16. The whole world has gone to hot tar. And for an eternity, the strapping co-ed with Nashville in her hair blocks Scott from her view. All she can see is Dashmeal's shoulder and Tony Eddington leafing back through the pages of his damn notebook. Then the co-ed finally clears Lisi's field of vision, and as Dashmeal and her husband come into full view again, Lisi sees the English teacher's head snap up and his body go on red alert. It happens in an instant. Lisi sees what Dashmeal sees. She sees Blondie with the gun. It will prove to be a Ladysmith 22, made in Korea and bought at a garage sale in South Nashville for $37, pointed at her husband, who has at last seen the danger and stopped. In Lisi time, all this happens very, very slowly. She does not actually see the bullet fly out of the 22's muzzle, not quite, but she hears Scott say very mildly, seeming to draw the words over the course of 10 or even 15 seconds. "Let's talk about it, son, right?" And then she sees fire bloom from the gun's nickel-plated muzzle in an uneven yellow-white corsage. She hears a pop, stupid, insignificant, the sound of someone breaking a paper lunch sack with the palm of his hand. She sees Dashmeal, that southern fried chicken shit, go jackrabbiting off on his immediate left. She sees Scott buck backward on his heels. At the same time, his chin thrusts forward. The combination is weird and graceful, like a dance floor move. A black hole blinks open on the right side of his summer sport coat. "Son, you honest to God don't want to do that," he says in his drawling Lisi time voice. And even in Lisi time, she can hear how his voice grows thinner on every word until he sounds like a test pilot in a high-altitude chamber. Yet Lisi thinks he still doesn't know he's been shot. She's almost positive. His sport coat swings open like a gate as he puts his hand out in a commanding "stop this" gesture, and she realizes two things simultaneously. The first is that the shirt inside his coat is turning red. The second is that she has at last broken into some semblance of a run. "I gotta end all this ding-dong," says Gert Allen Cole with perfect fretful clarity. "I gotta end all this ding-dong for the Frisias." And Lisi is suddenly sure that once Scott is dead, once the damage is done, Blondie will either kill himself or pretend to try. For the time being, however, he has this business to finish. The business of the writer. Blondie turns his wrist slightly so that the smoking barrel of the Ladysmith 22 points at the left side of Scott's chest. In Lisi time, the move is smooth and slow. He has done the lung. Now he'll do the heart. Lisi knows she can't allow that to happen. If her husband is to have any chance at all, this lethal goofball mustn't be allowed to put any more lead into him. As if repudiating her, Gerd Allen Cole says, "It never ends till you go down. You're responsible for all these repetitions, old boy. You are hell. You are a monkey. And now you are my monkey." This speech is the closest he comes to making sense, and making it gives Lisi just enough time to first wind up with the silver spade. The body knows its business, and her hands have already found their position near the top of the thing's 40-inch handle, and then swing it. Still, it's close. If it had been a horse race, the tote board would undoubtedly have flashed the "hold tickets, wait for photo" message. But when the race is between a man with a gun and a woman with a shovel, you don't need a photo. In slowed-down Lisi time, she sees the silver scoop strike the gun, driving it upward just as that corsage of fire blooms again. She can see only part of it this time, and the muzzle is completely hidden by the blade of the spade. She sees the business end of the ceremonial shovel carry on forward and upward as the second shot goes harmlessly into the hot August sky. She sees the gun fly loose, and there's time to think, "Holy smuck, I really put a charge into this one," before the spade connects with Blondie's face. His hand is still in there. 3 of those long, slim fingers will be broken. But the spade's silver bowl connects solidly just the same, breaking Cole's nose, shattering his right cheekbone and the bony orbit around his staring right eye, shattering 9 teeth as well. A mafia goon with a set of brass knuckles couldn't have done better. And now, still slow, still in Lisi time, the elements of Stephen Queensland's award-winning photograph are assembling themselves.
Captain S. Heffernan has seen what's happening only a second or two after Lisi, but he also has to deal with the bystander problem. In his case, a fat, bepimpled fella wearing baggy Bermuda shorts and a t-shirt with Scott Landon's smiling face on it. Captain Heffernan shunts this young fella aside with one muscular shoulder. By then, Blondie is sinking to the ground, and out of the forthcoming photo's field, with a dazed expression in one eye and blood pouring from the other. Blood is also gushing from the hole which at some future date may again serve as his mouth. Heffernan completely misses the actual hit. Roger Dashmeal, maybe remembering that he's supposed to be the master of ceremonies and not a big old bunny rabbit, turns back toward Eddington, his protege, and Landon, his troublesome guest of honor, just in time to take his place as a staring, slightly blurred face in the forthcoming photo's background. Scott Landon, meanwhile, shock walks right out of the award-winning photo. He walks as though unmindful of the heat, striding toward the parking lot and Nelson Hall beyond, which is home of the English department and mercifully air-conditioned. He walks with surprising briskness, at least to begin with, and a goodly part of the crowd moves with him, unaware for the most part that anything has happened. Lisi is both infuriated and unsurprised. After all, how many of them saw Blondie with that cuntish little pistol in his hand? How many of them recognized the burst paper bag sounds as gunshots? The hole in Scott's coat could be a smudge of dirt from his shoveling chore, and the blood that has soaked his shirt is as yet invisible to the outside world. He's now making a strange whistling noise each time he inhales, but how many of them hear that? No, it's her they're looking at. Some of them, anyway. The crazy chick who just inexplicably hauled off and whacked some guy in the face with the ceremonial silver spade. A lot of them are actually grinning, as if they believe it's all part of a show being put on for their benefit, the Scott Landon Roadshow. Well, fuck them, and fuck Dashmeal, and fuck the day-late and dollar-short campus cop with his perfectly huge batch of orifice. All she cares about now is Scott. She thrusts the shovel out not quite blindly to her right, and Eddington, their rent-a-Boswell, takes it. It's either that or get hit in the nose with it. Then, still in that horrible slow-mo, Lisi runs after her husband, whose briskness evaporates as soon as he reaches the suck-oven heat of the parking lot. Behind her, Tony Eddington is peering at the silver spade, as if it might be an artillery shell, a radiation detector, or the leaving of some great departed race. And to him comes Captain S. Heffernan, with his mistaken assumption of who today's hero must be. Lisi is unaware of this part, will know none of it until she sees Queensland's photograph 18 years later, would care about none of it even if she did know. All her attention is fixed on her husband, who has just gone down on his hands and knees in the parking lot. She tries to repudiate Lisi time to run faster, and that is when Queensland snaps his picture, catching just one half of one shoe on the far right-hand side of the frame, something he will not realize then or ever. 6. The Pulitzer Prize winner, the enfant terrible, who published his first novel at the tender age of 22, goes down. Scott Landon hits the deck, as the saying is. Lisi makes a supreme effort to pull out of the maddening time glue in which she seems to be trapped. She must get free, because if she doesn't reach him before the crowd surrounds him and shuts her out, they will very likely kill him with their concern, with smother love. "He's hurt!" someone shouts. She screams at herself in her own head. "Strap it on. Strap it on right now." And that finally does it. The glue in which she has been packed is gone. Suddenly she is knifing forward. All the world is noise and heat and sweat and jostling bodies. She blesses the speedy reality of it, even as she uses her left hand to grab the left cheek of her ass and pull, raking the goddamn underwear out of the crack of her goddamn ass. There, at least one thing about this wrong and broken day is now mended. A co-ed in the kind of shell top where the straps tie at the shoulders in big floppy bows threatens to block her narrowing path to Scott, but Lisi ducks beneath her and hits the hot top. She won't be aware of her scraped and blistered knees until much later, until the hospital, in fact, where a kindly paramedic will notice and put lotion on them, something so cool and soothing it will make her cry with relief. But that is for later. Now it might as well be just her and Scott alone on the edge of this hot parking lot,
This terrible black and yellow ballroom floor, which must be 130 degrees at least, maybe 150. Her mind tries to present her with an image of an egg frying sunny side up in Goodma's old black iron spider, and Lisi blocks it out. Scott is looking at her. He gazes up, and now his face is waxy pale, except for the sooty smudges forming beneath his hazel eyes and the fat string of blood which has begun to flow from the right side of his mouth and down along his jaw.
Lisi!
That thin, whooping, high-altitude chamber voice.
Did that guy really shoot me?
Don't try to talk. She puts a hand on his chest. His shirt, oh dear God, is soaked with blood, and beneath it she can feel his heart running along so fast and light. It is not the heartbeat of a human being, but of a bird. Pigeon pulse, she thinks. And that's when the girl with the floppy bows tied on her shoulders falls on top of her. She would land on Scott, but Lisi instinctively shields him. Taking the brunt of the girl's weight,
hey, shit, fuck,
the startled girl cries out, with her back. That weight is there for only a second, and then gone. Lisi sees the girl shoot her hands out to break her fall. Oh, the divine reflexes of the young, she thinks, as though she herself were ancient instead of just 31. And the girl is successful, but then she is yipping,
ow, ow, ow,
as the asphalt heats her skin.
Lisi,
Scott whispers, and oh Christ, how his breath screams when he pulls it in, like wind in a chimney.
Who pushed me?
The girl with the bows on her shoulders is demanding. She's a hunker, hair from a busted ponytail in her eyes, crying in shock, pain, and embarrassment. Lisi leans close to Scott. The heat of him terrifies her, and fills her with pity deeper than any she thought it was possible to feel. He is actually shivering in the heat. Awkwardly, using only one arm, she strips off her jacket.
Yes, you've been shot, so just be quiet and don't try to... I'm so hot,
he says, and begins to shiver harder. What comes next, convulsions? His hazel eyes stare up into her blue ones. Blood runs from the corner of his mouth. She can smell it. Even the collar of his shirt is soaking in red. His tea cure wouldn't be any good here, she thinks, not even sure what she is thinking about.
Too much blood this time, too smuckin' much. I'm so hot. Lisi, please give me ice.
I will, she says, and puts her jacket under his head. I will, Scott. Thank God he's wearing his sport coat, she thinks, and then has an idea. She grabs the hunkering, crying girl by the arm.
What's your name?
The girl stares as if she were mad, but answers the question.
Lisa Lemke.
Another Lisa, small world, Lisi thinks, but does not say. What she says is, my husband's been shot, Lisa. Can you go over there to... She cannot remember the name of the building, only its function. To the English department and call an ambulance, dial 911. Ma'am? Mrs. Landon? This is the campus security cop with the perfectly huge badge, making his way through the crowd with a lot of help from his meaty elbows. He squats beside her and his knees pop. Louder than Blondie's pistol, Lisi thinks. He's got a walkie-talkie in one hand. He speaks slowly and carefully as though to a distressed child. I've called the campus infirmary, Mrs. Landon. They are rolling their ambulance, which will take your husband to Nashville Memorial. Do you understand me? She does, and her gratitude, the cop has made up the dollar short he owed and a few more in Lisi's opinion, is almost as deep as the pity she feels for her husband, lying on the simmering pavement and trembling like a distempered dog. She nods, weeping the first of what will be many tears before she gets Scott back to Maine. Not on a Delta flight, but in a private plane and with a private nurse on board, and with another ambulance and another private nurse to meet them at the Portland Jetport's Civil Aviation Terminal. Now she turns back to the Lemke girl and says,
he's burning up. Is there ice, honey? Can you think of anywhere that there might be ice? Anywhere at all?
She says this without much hope, and is therefore amazed when Lisa Lemke nods at once.
There's a snack center with a Coke machine right over there.
She points in the direction of Nelson Hall, which Lisi can't see. All she can see is a crowding forest of bare legs, some hairy, some smooth, some tanned, some sunburned. She realizes they're completely hemmed in, that she's tending her fallen husband in a slot the shape of a large vitamin pill or cold capsule, and she feels a touch of crowd panic. Is the word for that agoraphobia? Scott would know.
If you can get him some ice, please do, Lisi says, and hurry.
She turns to the campus security cop, who appears to be taking Scott's pulse, a completely useless activity in Lisi's opinion. Right now it's down to either alive or dead. "Can you make them move back?" she says, almost pleads. "It's so hot, and..." Before she can finish, he's up like Jack from his box, yelling, "Move it back! Let this girl through! Move it back and let this girl through! Let him breathe, folks! What do you say?" The crowd shuffles back. Very reluctantly, it seems to Lisi. They don't want to miss any of the blood, it seems to her. The heat bakes up from the pavement. She has half expected to get used to it, the way you get used to a hot shower, but that isn't happening. She listens for the howl of the approaching ambulance and hears nothing. Then she does. She hears Scott saying her name, croaking her name. At the same time, he twitches at the side of the sweat-soaked shell top she's wearing. Her bra now stands out against the silk as stark as a swollen tattoo. She looks down and sees something she doesn't like at all. Scott is smiling. The blood has coated his lips a rich candy red, top to bottom, side to side, and the smile actually looks more like the grin of a clown. "No one loves a clown at midnight," she thinks, and wonders where that came from. It will only be at some point during the long and mostly sleepless night ahead of her, listening to what will seem like every dog in Nashville bark at the hot August moon, that she'll remember it was the epigram of Scott's third novel, the only one both she and the critics hated, the one that made them rich. Empty Devils. Scott continues to twitch at her blue silk top, his eyes still so brilliant and fevery in their blackening sockets. He has something to say, and, reluctantly, she leans down to hear it. He pulls air in a little at a time, in half gasps. It is a noisy, frightening process. The smell of blood is even stronger up close. Nasty. A mineral smell. It's death. It's the smell of death. As if to ratify this, Scott says, "It's very close, honey. I can't see it, but I..." Another long, screaming intake of breath. "I hear it taking its meal. And grunting." Smiling that bloody clown smile as he says it. "Scott, I don't know what you're The hand that has been tugging at her top has some strength left in it, after all. It pinches her side, and cruelly. When she takes the top off much later in the motel room, she'll see a bruise, a true lover's knot. "You..." Screamy breath. "No." Another screamy breath, deeper. And still grinning as if they share some horrible secret. A purple secret. The color of bruises. The color of certain flowers that grow on certain... Hush, Lisi. Oh, hush. Yes, on certain hillsides. "You... know. So don't... insult my... intelligence." Another whistling, screaming breath. "Or your own." And she supposes she does know some of it. The long boy, he calls it. Or the thing with the endless piebald side. Once she meant to look up piebald in the dictionary, but she forgot. Forgetting is a skill she has had reason to polish during the years she and Scott have been together. But she knows what he's talking about. Yes. He lets go. Or maybe just loses the strength to hold on. Lisi pulls back a little, not far. His eyes regard her from their deep and blackening sockets. They are as brilliant as ever, but she sees they are also full of terror, and, this is what frightens her most, some wretched, inexplicable amusement. Still speaking low, perhaps so only she can hear, maybe because it's the best he can manage, Scott says, "Listen, little Lisi. I'll make how it sounds when it looks around." "Scott, no. You have to stop." He pays no attention. He draws in another of those screaming breaths, purses his wet red lips in a tight O, and makes a low, incredibly nasty chuffing noise. It drives a fine spray of blood up his clenched throat and into the sweltering air. A girl sees it and screams. This time the crowd doesn't need the campus cop to ask them to move back. They do it on their own, leaving Lisi, Scott, and Captain Heffernan a perimeter of at least 4 feet all the way around. The sound, dear God, it really is a kind of grunting, is mercifully short. Scott coughs, his chest heaving, the wound spilling more blood in rhythmic pulses, then beckons her back down with one finger. She comes, leaning on her simmering hands. His socketed eyes compel her, so does his mortal grin. He turns his head to the side, spits a wad of half-congealed blood onto the hot tar, then turns back to her.
I could call it that way, he whispers. It would come. You'd be rid of my everlasting quack.
She understands that he means it, and for a moment, surely it is the power of his eyes, she believes it's true. He will make the sound again, only a little louder, and in some other world the long boy, that lord of sleepless nights, will turn its unspeakable hungry head. A moment later in this world, Scott Landon will simply shiver on the pavement and die. The death certificate will say something sane, but she'll know. His dark thing finally saw him and came for him and ate him alive. So now come the things they will never speak of later, not to others or between themselves. Too awful. Each marriage has two hearts, one light and one dark. This is the dark heart of theirs, the one mad, true secret. She leans close to him on the baking pavement, sure he is dying, nevertheless determined to hold on to him if she can. If it means fighting the long boy for him, with nothing but her fingernails, if it comes to that, she will.
Well, Lacey?
Smiling that repulsive, knowing, terrible smile.
What do you say?
Leaning even closer, into the shivering sweat and blood stink of him. Leaning in until she can smell the last palest ghost of the Prel he shampooed with that morning and the foamy he shaved with. Leaning in until her lips touch his ear. She whispers,
"Be quiet, Scott. For once in your life, just be quiet."
When she looks at him again, his eyes are different. The fierceness is gone. He's fading. But maybe that's all right, because he looks sane again.
Lacey.
Still whispering, looking directly into his eyes.
Leave that smoking thing alone and it will go away.
For a moment she almost adds, you can take care of the rest of this mess later. But the idea is senseless. For a while, the only thing Scott can do for himself is not die. What she says is,
don't you ever make that noise again.
He licks at his lips. She sees the blood on his tongue and it turns her stomach, but she doesn't pull away from him. She supposes she's in this now until the ambulance hauls him away or he quits breathing right here on this hot pavement 100 yards or so from his latest triumph. If she can stick through that last, she guesses she can stick through anything.
I'm so hot, he says. If only I had a piece of ice to suck.
Soon, Lacey says, not knowing if she's promising rashly and not caring. I'm getting it for you. At least she can hear the ambulance howling its way toward them. That's something. And then, a kind of miracle. The girl with the bows on her shoulders and the new scrapes on her palms fights her way to the front of the crowd. She's gasping like someone who has just run a race, and sweat is running down her cheeks and neck, but she's holding two big, waxed paper cups in her hands.
I spilled half the fucking Coke getting back here, she says,
throwing a brief, baleful glance over her shoulder at the crowd.
But I got the ice okay. Ice, isn't that?
Then her eyes roll up almost to the whites and she reels backward all loosey-goosey in her sneakers. The campus cop, oh bless him with many blessings, a huge batch of orifice and all, grabs her, steadies her, and takes one of the cups. He hands it to Lacey, then urges the other Lisa to drink from the remaining cup. Lacey Landon pays no attention. Later, replaying all this, she'll be in a little awe of her own single-mindedness. Now she only thinks, just keep her from falling on top of me again if she faints, Officer Friendly, and turns back to Scott. He's shivering worse than ever, and his eyes are dulling out, losing their grasp on her. And still, he tries.
Lacey. So hot. Ice.
I have it, Scott. Now will you for once just shut your everlasting mouth?
One went north, one went south,
he croaks, and then he does what she asks. Maybe he's all talked out, which would be a Scott Landon first. Lisi drives her hand deep into the cup, sending Coke all the way to the top and splooshing it over the edge. The cold is shocking and utterly wonderful. She clutches a good handful of ice chips, thinking how ironic this is. Whenever she and Scott stop at a turnpike rest area and she uses a machine that dispenses cups of soda instead of cans or bottles, she always hammers on the no ice button, feeling righteous. Others may allow the evil soft drink companies to shortchange them by dispensing half a cup of soda and half a cup of ice. But not Dave DeBuscher's baby girl, Lisa. What was old Dandy saying? I didn't fall off a hayrick yesterday. And now here she is, wishing for even more ice and less Coke. Not that she thinks it will make much difference. But on that one, she's in for a surprise. Scott, here, ice. His eyes are half closed now. But he opens his mouth, and when she first rubs his lips with her handful of ice and then pops one of the melting shards onto his bloody tongue, his shivering suddenly stops. God, it's magic. Emboldened, she rubs her freezing, leaking hand along his right cheek, his left cheek, and then across his forehead, where drops of Coke-colored water drip into his eyebrows and then run down the sides of his nose.
Oh, Lisi, that's heaven,
he says, and although still screamy, his voice sounds more with it to her, more there. The ambulance has pulled up on the left side of the crowd with a dying growl of its siren, and a few seconds later she can hear an impatient male voice shouting, Paramedics, let us through! Paramedics, come on, people, let us through so we can do our jobs, what do you say? Dashmeal, the southern fried asshole, chooses this moment to speak in Lisi's ear. The solicitude in his voice, given the speed with which he jackrabbited, makes her want to grind her teeth.
How is he, darling?
Without looking around, she replies, trying to live. 7. Trying to live, she murmured, running her palm over the glossy page in the U10 Nashville Review, over the picture of Scott with his foot poised on that dopey silver shovel. She closed the book with a snap and tossed it onto the dusty back of the book snake. Her appetite for pictures, for memories, was more than sated for one day. There was a nasty throb starting up behind her right eye. She wanted to take something for it, not that sissy Tylenol, but what her late husband had called head bonkers. A couple of his Excedrin would be just the ticket, if they weren't too far off the shelf date. Then a little lie down in their bedroom until the incipient headache passed. She might even sleep a while. I'm still thinking of it as our bedroom, she mused, going to the stairs that lead down to the barn, which was now not really a barn at all, but just a series of storage cubbies, though still redolent of hay and rope and tractor oil, the old sweet, stubborn farm smells. Still as ours, even after 2 years. And so what? What of that? She shrugged. Nothing, I suppose. She was a little shocked at the mumbly, half-drunk sound of the words. She supposed all that vivid remembering had worn her out, all that relived stress. There was one thing to be grateful for. No other picture of Scott in the belly of the book snake could call up such violent memories. He'd only been shot once, and none of those colleges would have sent him photos of his Shut up about that, just hush. That's right, she agreed as she reached the bottom of the stairs, and with no real idea of what she'd been on the edge, scoot you old scoot, of thinking about. Her head was hanging and she felt sweaty all over, like someone who has just missed being in an accident.
Shut up, Ski, enough is enough.
And, as if her voice had activated it, a telephone began to ring behind the closed wooden door on her right. Lisi came to a stop in the barn's main downstairs passage. Once that door had opened upon a stabling area large enough for 3 horses. Now the sign on it simply said, High Voltage. This had been Lisi's idea of a joke. She had intended to put a small office in there, a place where she could keep records and pay the monthly bills. They had, and she still had, a full-time money manager. But he was in New York and could not be expected to see to such minutiae as her monthly tab at Hilltop Grocery. She'd gotten as far as putting in the desk, the phone, the fax, and a few filing cabinets. And then Scott died. Had she even been in there since then?
Once, she remembered, early this spring. Late March, a few stale stoles of snow.